this Friday afternoon. I want to thank everyone for being patient with us. Due to the events today, some of us had meetings that we weren't planning on, and that caused us to start late today. We will always try to get started on time, but being a supplemental session with a lot of things happening in a very short period of time, sometimes we are not always able to be on time for our own hearings. So thank you very much for allowing us that time to regroup. What we're going to do at this point is we're going to start with two bills that we had past Tuesday, which was on February 5th. We'll start with Senate Bill 186, and I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 186 at this time. It should be noted that because of some oversights...
186.
I think you said Senate Bill
1086.
Oh.
1086.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Because of some problems that occurred in the early part of the week where the staff were posting these notices for these various bills to be heard, it turns out that two of our bills, Senate Bill 1086 as well as 1088, were not properly posted in front of the Senate chamber. And so what we need to do is take a moment to incorporate the testimony that we heard on Tuesday into our record of today. So, again, we're starting with a public hearing on 1086. And Senator Wissett, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move incorporation of testimony heard Tuesday, February 5th, 2008, in this committee as part of today's record.
Senator Wissett moves that we incorporate the testimony we heard on February 5th regarding Senate Bill 1086 as part of the record today. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And at this point, we're going to go ahead and open it up. I know that I think most of the interested parties who are here for 1086 have already given testimony, but I want to give those who are here today who have not had an opportunity to give testimony on 1086 that opportunity. So I don't have, let's see, I guess we have Mary Botkin is the only one that's scheduled. Is anyone else wanted to make comments on this while she comes up? Please.
I'm not even down, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. Good bill should pass. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we won't ask if there's any questions. The other thing I want to put on the record, there is an individual that has come forward that has presented the chair and the vice chair this afternoon or late morning with a possible amendment to 1086. Due to the lateness of time for that amendment and not being able to get the individuals here that we need to have to get clarification as to the full impact of that, the chair has instructed that it would be probably more favorable for him to bring it to the House side, which he will be doing, and that the chair is open to consider that if, in fact, the amendment is adopted on the House side, and we would then consider whether we would be adopting it outright or if we would need to go to a conference committee. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1086, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1086.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1086.
Mr. Chair, if I could, sorry to interject, but I want to clarify to the committee that we have in front of us the Dash 3 amendments, and you may remember there was discussion last Tuesday as it relates to the terminology on page 2, line 2, Department of Public Safety and Standards and Training. I think is originally we talked about the Bureau. I want to clarify that. That's the only change in the Dash 2 that we had the last time. So we have to adopt the Dash 3.
Yes.
We did that conceptually, Mr. Chairman of the committee.
Yes, I remember that. And so, Senator Wissett.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1086.
Senator Wissett moves the Dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 1086. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1086 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wissett moves Senate Bill 1086 as amended by the Dash 3 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered, and we'll have Senator Garrod, if you will still be so kind to carry our first bill to the Senate floor, we would be honored.
Well, I look forward to doing that.
And so do we.
I thought you might.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1086.
What legislators does it take to pass a bill, Senator?
Half of what it takes
on the light bulb.
We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1088. And Senator Wissett, if we could have a motion on, regarding the record.
Mr. Chair, I move incorporation of testimony heard Tuesday, February 5th, 2008, on Senate Bill 1088.
Senator Wissett moves that we adopt or incorporate into the record the testimony we heard on Tuesday, February 5th, into today's record. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And at this point, we've heard from a few people in council. Why don't you bring us up to
speed? Chair, I just want to remind people that we adopted the Dash 1 amendments on Tuesday, and we'll need to do so again today.
The Dash 1s?
Dash 1.
All right.
Same one we adopted last Tuesday.
Before I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1088, is there anyone here that would like to give testimony today in addition to what we've already heard on Tuesday? Not seeing any, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1088 and open a work session on 1088. Senator Wissett.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1088.
Senator Wissett moves the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 1088. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1088 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wissett moves the Senate Bill 1088 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered, and I think the chair said he was going to carry that one.
You did. That's in my notes.
And so the chair will continue to be the carrier on that. We'll close the public hearing on 1088, and now we're going to start back to the top of our agenda with a public hearing. I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1095. And Senator Wissett, I believe you're the sponsor of the bill, and I'm wondering if you'd like to assume the position behind the dais there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Doug Whitsett. I represent Senate District 28 in the Oregon Senate. Wonder if I might also invite Marion County Sheriff Russ Isham and Deputy District Attorney Katie Suber to the podium with me, please.
Yes, you may. Please come forward.
Mr. Chair, briefly, this bill requires a minimum $500,000 security bail bond for anyone charged for the manufacture or distribution of methamphetamine in a quantity sufficient to require periods of incarceration in level 6 or 8 in the matrix. The bill is designed to close the prevalent revolving door of arrest charges, bond posting, followed by further offenses and by repeated arrest charges and bond postings. We believe that the $500,000 bond is not excessive, but rather appropriate for these crimes that in our minds are in many ways worse than aggravated murder. Those who manufacture and purvey large quantities of methamphetamine are killing our youth, killing our families, and killing our communities. With premeditated purpose, these criminals are sentencing their victims to hell on earth, sentencing them to prolonged downward spiral of an addiction that they know will lead to certain destruction of the victim's character, their health, their family, their community, and ultimately, even their life. They know with certainty that once addicted to methamphetamine, their victims will be unable to break the bonds of that addiction. They know with certainty that most of their victims will be forced by that addiction into a life of criminal activity to support their dependency on methamphetamine. Mr. Chair, the greatest cost is in the human tragedy. The cost to our communities and the state is simply immeasurable. And with that, I will stop talking and let the certified smart people tell you about this bill.
All right. And who would like to be the first certified smart?
Well, thanks.
Please state your name.
My name is Katie Suber. I'm a deputy district attorney in Marion County. I'm here on behalf of the Marion County District Attorney's Office as well as the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I can tell you is that beginning in August of 2006, the Marion County Circuit Court bench changed the standard bail amounts in Marion County. For anyone who is lodged at the Marion County Jail on a charge of delivery of methamphetamine or manufacture of methamphetamine or possession of methamphetamine involving a substantial quantity, that individual's standard bail amount is $500,000. So we have been able to actually see this in its practical application for about a year and a half now. And as a prosecutor assigned to the drug unit, and I'm also the prosecutor that's assigned to the methamphetamine strike force in Marion County, which is an interagency drug team that is tasked with the enforcement primarily of mid and upper level methamphetamine traffickers through Marion County, I can tell you that this has had nothing but a positive impact in my ability to prosecute offenders and hold them accountable in a couple of ways. From a practical standpoint, what I can tell you is that historically when police officers conduct a long-term investigation, as I'm sure you can imagine, these methamphetamine dealers are not typically caught in a traffic stop by happenstance. It's a significant amount of work hours on the part of police. Sometimes these investigations are months long. And when they finally do make an arrest and are able to lodge an individual in custody, the fact that they know within an hour that person isn't simply going to be released from custody and back out into the community gives them that sense of satisfaction that their months and months of work has not been for nothing. In addition, as I'm sure you can tell, the byproduct of that is the immediate public safety solution that we see from keeping these people in custody after they've been investigated for several months and after they've been selling methamphetamine in our communities for that long. As a practical standpoint, from a prosecutor's perspective, it allows us to negotiate these cases at a much greater speed. In other words, when defendants are held in custody, they don't typically delay these cases for months or even years. They don't tend to drag through the system. And most importantly, we know where they are. They don't fail to appear in court because they aren't released from custody with the opportunity to fail to appear. So we know where they are and we know where to find them. I anticipate that possibly some of the opposition to this might include that this bail amount is excessive. And obviously we have certain statutes in Oregon that require judges to go through release criteria in determining whether to set security amounts and what those security amounts should be. Those release criteria include, but aren't limited to, the reasonable protection of the public and the likelihood that someone is going to come back to court. And both of those things are, for good reason, the primary reasons that the court set significant amounts of security. Drug dealers, and particularly methamphetamine dealers, have a significant amount of cash at their disposal. Really, at any given time, and I'm not just talking about cash, there are certainly other assets, cars, other types of, you know, equipment and things that they can sell, things that will allow them to obtain the amount of security that they need to get out of custody. And as Senator Whitsitt pointed out, some of these people don't even have to post security. They just go right through the revolving door and back out. So this security amount, first of all, comports with what Oregon law requires in terms of judicial discretion in determining what an appropriate security amount is for a particular crime. It helps us, from a law enforcement and prosecution perspective, to hold these people accountable. And lastly, I do want to point out, and I'm sure that this is probably a concern of the committee, if you keep a meth dealer in custody or a meth manufacturer in custody, who are you having to let out? And certainly that is something that should be looked at from this committee standpoint and from a public policy standpoint. And that's why I think Sheriff Isham would probably do a little bit better in being able to tell you how this has affected our jail population, whether this has had an impact on our ability to hold, for example, violent offenders in custody pending trial or pending sentencing as well. From an anecdotal perspective, I can tell you that I have not seen any significant change in our ability to hold violent offenders and other offenders who, for public safety reasons, we need to keep in custody since we've had this standard bail amount in Marion County. So I would urge you to pass this bill.
Questions?
Yeah.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Suver, I wasn't aware there was a statutory criteria for judges, but there is, and I was waiting for you to tell me how this gets around the statutory criteria that they have in setting release amounts. So if we set the release amount for them, then how can a judge independently, through his or her own discretion, then set an amount that may be different?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, if I may respond, I guess I would first point out the fact that there are other laws which set mandatory bail amounts. If I may point to Section 40 of the Oregon Constitution, which was passed, I believe, by ballot measure through the voters, for violent offenders, ballot measure 11 offenders, murder and treason, they're not entitled to bail unless a defendant requests a hearing in which a court has the discretion to impose security, but it has to be a minimum of $50,000. Senator, you're obviously correct that this bill, as it is written, doesn't include that type of judicial discretion. But even if that was part of the discussion and an amendment could be made that we could incorporate that type of judicial discretion, I think the purpose behind the bill of setting a minimum bail amount is appropriate. And I don't believe the $500,000 is excessive. So certainly I understand the concern, but I would point to the fact that there are other constitutional and statutory provisions that mandate certain bail amounts for other crimes. And so I think that there is a way, even if we need to amend this bill, to get to the same point.
Thank you.
Ms. Hubert, Senator.
The question I would have, and thank you, Chair, is how much of the meth problem is coming from outside the U.S. borders? We're hearing quite a bit that it seems to be coming from south of the border. Have you noticed that that tends to be trending that way, and that, too, would kind of add to the argument of getting at least $500,000?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, the evidence that we have, particularly from a law enforcement perspective, is that the majority of methamphetamine is coming from Mexico, Central America, and is being transported up through the United States. I can tell you from a prosecution standpoint that the legislative decisions to put pseudoephedrine behind the counter has caused a dramatic increase in meth labs in the state of Oregon, certainly in Marion County. I haven't even prosecuted someone for manufacturing methamphetamine for probably over 18 months. So the source of supply has to come from somewhere. And what we know is that it is coming from Mexico, Central America, and coming up through the United States. And, of course, the I-5 corridor is and always has been a significant method of transporting that. There are offenders that I see who are Mexican nationals who, when they're brought into custody, also have immigration holds and face deportation, whether convicted or not. And I'm actually glad that you asked this question, because one of the practical realities is with an immigration hold, if a person is released from custody, then immigration will actually take enforcement on that individual. They don't hold them for prosecution in Marion County. They don't hold them to be prosecuted even by the federal government. Those individuals have to be held in custody. So with Senator Whitsitt's example, where we have, again, this revolving door, if the person had an immigration hold and they get released on their Marion County charge, immigration is going to take over at that point, and we won't likely be able to find that person again to follow through with prosecution. So there is that sort of companion issue that goes with this.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you. Is it Suver?
Suver, yes.
Yes. And I just want to put a couple things on the record, just to make sure we got a good record here. I would assume that these individuals, because of the type of levels that they're dealing with and their ability to access for cash and assets, are probably a greater flight risk to a community than in other types of crime.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would agree with that.
And also, I'm wondering, since Marion County has already had this in place now, from what I understand, over a year, have you seen legal challenges being raised regarding this security release level or amount?
Mr. Chair, no, I have not. There have been no constitutional challenges to excessive bail let me clarify that. Not that I know of, I should say. And I think I would probably know of them, given that Marion County is not too big, if they did occur.
Okay. And the other thing, just for the record, with a minimum of $500,000 under our current system, that would mean that the individual would need to be posting 10%, $50,000?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. $50,000 in some form of cash, money order. I think in some jails they even take credit cards.
All right. And the last, I think, just I understand that the vast majority that we've been able to document is coming, let's say, from the south to the north. But that doesn't mean that we're not seeing methamphetamines and other controlled substances coming across the Canadian border and also into the U.S. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct.
All right. That's all the questions I have. Sheriff, welcome. Thank you very much for being here. And welcome to, I would assume, maybe your first appearance here as the sheriff of Marion County.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
If I can get you to just move the microphone a little closer to you to get you on the record, and if you identify yourself for the record, we'd love to hear your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Russ Eichmann. I'm the sheriff for Marion County. And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1095 today. I believe the people that are intended that this bill addresses, the people who manufacture and deliver methamphetamine, are pose a significant threat to our public safety, and that's why I'm here today to talk a little bit about what Ms. Suber had said. For Marion County, I can tell you from our perspective, we have not seen a significant increase in the amount of people that are being held in Marion County Jail. To address specifically, are we releasing violent offenders because we're holding people in jail for these particular crimes? We are not releasing violent offenders back into the community, and I don't see that that's going to happen specifically for us here in Marion County. So for those reasons, I am in support of 1095, and I'm happy to answer any questions, but basically, financially or manpower-wise or anything else, we've not seen that increase.
All right, thank you, Sheriff. Questions?
No.
Senator.
Mr. Chair, before I invite our third guest here, I wanted to make a couple of examples. In Jackson County recently, we had an individual who was arrested for possession and actually sale of a half a pound of methamphetamine. Previously, he had been arrested for possession of methamphetamine in 1998, manufacture of methamphetamine in 1999, and delivery of methamphetamine in 2003. In the last two cases, he received 3 years probation and 90 days in jail. The second example was in Klamath Falls recently, and about 3 months ago. There was a gentleman that had been arrested for possession and distribution of methamphetamine three times and had bailed himself out. On his fourth arrest, he was arrested for two counts of aggravated murder and one count of attempted aggravated murder, where high on methamphetamine, he entered these people's apartment, who he knew, got upset, pulled out a gun, and just simply started killing people. I think we need to close that revolving door. And then I'm going to relinquish my seat here to the facilitator of the Blue Ribbon Meth Task Force, Mr. Mike Ryan.
Okay, thank you, Senator. Mr. Ryan, thank you very much for appearing today. If you'll give us your name for the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Durant. My name is Mike Ryan. I work for Professional Mortgage Corporation here in the community, and I'm here representing the Methamphetamine Task Force of Marion County. It actually was created by the last legislative session by way of a budget note. And the purpose for the task force itself was to work in the community to see if it would be possible to create a model for other communities to view as we take action in Marion County in a replication of way, not as a cookie cutter, but as some of the examples of what we can take in a community in a comprehensive manner dealing with methamphetamine. One of the byproducts of the work of the task force was the creation of a strike force. And that is a really unique private-public partnership that has been created here in Marion County, where the private sector has come forth with the initial dollars in support of the strike force, $300,000 in support of that. The legislature, through the emergency board, contributed $100,000 to put that in place. And what is the legislation before you currently is a byproduct of all of that work that's going on in the community. And from the task force's perspective, we see this as a real key accountability tool or a weapon that any community would view favorably to have in place. And from a lay citizen standpoint, as I am and a volunteer doing this facilitation work, looking at it, it is an absolute vital part of that puzzle when our criminal justice and law enforcement officials and professionals move through this very arduous process of targeting mid-level drug dealers for investigation, for arrest, prosecution, and imprisonment found after they're tried, to have this accountability in place so that those folks, in fact, are held for trial, we believe is absolutely critical, and that other communities would welcome as part of this replication model as well. So that is my purpose and my testimony today, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Ryan?
Yes, Chair.
Go ahead, Scott.
I'd just like to compliment the works that have taken place, because I do live in Marion County, and I think we have seen a major reduction. And as we said, the production of meth, and the problem has seemed to wane. So I think this is a good example of how to do it. And also, I'd like to welcome, I failed to do that, Sheriff Isham. I think that he's going to do a wonderful job as sheriff in Marion County.
Thank you. Ms. Seward, before you leave, I just want to, I guess, put it on the record. Based on how the bill is written, it talks about substantial quantities. I'm assuming those are what has been defined that's on the sentencing guidelines on the backside, where it says what the quantity amounts are. That is what we're looking at as to what would qualify for that as treatment?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor,
not yet, please.
Apparently, I can't even step out of a courtroom. Mr. Chair, that is correct.
I have done that in court, too. I do that all the time.
You've been elevated, I think.
Maybe. After today, the forecast that we've got. All right, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and call up Ann Christian and Steve Dole, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Christian. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Our membership includes attorneys who represent criminal defendants and also attorneys who represent parents in juvenile dependency cases where there's an allegation of abuse, and also our members represent the children in those dependency proceedings. And OCDLA, of course, supports public safety, and perhaps more than many, our members know the ravages of meth. We meet with our clients in custody, outside of custody, in their homes. And with that said, I would say the reason that we have concerns with this bill is twofold. The first is the judicial discretion piece of it, as Senator Walker raised the issue. We would like it just to be perfectly clear that the 500,000, if that's the number you go with, is simply the initial amount, and that the court, as in Measure 11 cases, as was discussed, clearly has the discretion to set a lower amount. Our second concern is related to that first concern, and it involves a case called State v. Sutherland from 1999 that addressed a statute that mandated $50,000 security for a Measure 11 case, so $50,000 as opposed to $500,000. And the Supreme Court held that although that $50,000 mandatory security was not facially unconstitutional in individual cases, certainly defense attorneys could argue to a particular client that it was unconstitutional based on the person's situation. So I'm here to just say we have concerns. I think if there were a clear provision with regard to judicial discretion, that would certainly help with our concerns with this bill. And I'm pleased, actually, to hear about the Marion County experience, because I didn't know that was going on, and we always like to be part of task forces that work on good works like this. So I applaud them on their experience. And in closing, I would just be interested, because I believe Mr. Dole has a concern that we originally had, which was who will be released. when these people are held in custody, is I would be interested in who is being released, because in most counties we do have a finite number of jail beds. Another issue is forfeiture, and frankly I don't quite know, Mr. Chair, you're the expert on forfeiture, where we are with regard to forfeiture for these individuals who do at least start out with many times large amounts of cash and assets. I don't know the extent to which those are being seized at the moment under forfeiture, but that's always a possibility. So with that said, I would be happy to answer questions and even work on amendments if that's appropriate. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's see. Mr. Mill, why don't you go ahead and give your testimony. I have a couple of questions I'm going to open up for both of you all just to see instead of asking each of the same thing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole with Crime Victims United of Oregon. I find myself in a little bit of an odd position on this. I actually marked myself down as against. I want to be clear about that. We support the bill. We support the principle that you're trying to get to here. Our main concern is what Ms. Christensen just mentioned, and that is that we don't want to see a situation where we're going to release violent criminals for this type of an offender. I understand they've worked that they're doing this in Marion County right now, and I applaud them, and that it's worked well. But that's one county out of 36, and we're particularly concerned about some of these smaller counties and the pressures that they're under fiscally, and of course with the federal forest payments and other issues that are going on, that they may in fact find themselves in a position where they're going to release a violent offender, and for that matter, even Multnomah County, which is of course the big one, we've got a situation where it looks like we're going to have less jail beds there by possibly as much as many as 200. So we just have we have serious concerns around that. We don't want violent people who have shown themselves to be violent released for someone who has a possession. And so I would like to see us, if it's appropriate, adopt some amendments around that issue. And I thank you for giving me the time to testify.
My pleasure. Questions? I'm going to ask you all a couple of things, because I was wondering, based on the work that we've been doing this session with the Property Crime Initiative and referral, we're looking at maybe having components in there that would be, let's say, having greater sanctions for those that have much higher levels of quantities, of what of the type of controlled substances. Have you all looked at that in relation to maybe this, of having instead of I don't have the sheet in front of me, but it's like 8 grams or 10 grams, whatever the numbers are, which is a lot, but at the same time, maybe it's broader than what needs to be for those really big rollers. And I guess one of the things I'd like for you to do is consider that. I told Senator Wissett that we're going to hear the bill, and we have till Tuesday to move the bill. And so that's one of the things I'd like for you all to maybe see if you can maybe come to some agreements as to whether we could have a threshold that would be higher than what's currently in the guidelines. That will still, being effective as to the intent that Senator Wissett's looking for, and I'm going to let you work with Senator Wissett, and he'll get back to me as to, what, if anything, he would be willing to move forward at this time. The other would be regarding the implied consent, or discretion, I should say, of the judges. I've always felt that the judges had that just automatic. And whether it needs to actually be explicit. And Steve, based on your work with Measure 11, I'm going to ask you as to looking at that, as to whatever language is currently in statute, if you think that would be appropriate to put in there to give that surety. Because I do believe that a judge has the inherent power. If when a person comes before them, they have to make that decision based on a case-by-case basis. I understand that this can be what we would consider a minimum threshold, with the understanding that under the circumstances that are presented to the court on that particular case, that they would have the flexibility to go below that if they found in that case the $500,000 would be excessive. I do not want us, and I'm trying to set a record here, to put us in a position that this would be a mandate that I think could, in fact, one, be challenged, and two, could actually have a reversal of what we want to do. I think there's a way of doing this, and it sounds like you've done this, and I don't know if you've shared any of this with the senator or not.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Wissett, just before the hearing, we talked a little about some of OCDLA's concerns. I'd be happy to work on this.
Okay. So let's realize our time frame. We have till Tuesday at this meeting. Our committee is scheduled to meet at 1 p.m., and we'll schedule it in by 3. We have to have all the bills done that we're going to be moving out of the committee completed by the end of Tuesday. That doesn't mean that we couldn't come back taking care of some stuff as amendments are tied up, but I'm also aware and that Legislative Council is going to have a pretty big push. So my hope is that you will meet with Senator Wissett this afternoon so we can kind of figure out what, if any, amendments would be appropriate, and that way we can get them into LC this afternoon, and they would have the weekend, and then hopefully get something back to us hopefully on Monday to have ready for Tuesday, or at least Tuesday, and we can factor that in, with the understanding because of the timeline we may move the bill let's say you agree to whatever amendments. If for some reason they can't be ready on Tuesday, then it would be the intent of the chair to move the bill and then address it on the House side. But I want to give you all the chance to kind of move it. I know that LC is willing to push out as quick as they can whatever they have before them, and so let's see if we can't give them a little more opportunity than waiting till Monday. Ms. Christian.
Mr. Chair, I have one question, whether the representative from the Marion County DA's Association could spend a bit of time with us as well.
Yeah, she's here, and I was going to ask if she would be willing. I think she will be. Yeah, this is not just for them, too. I definitely would like for you there. And, Steve, I think you're aware as to the numbers that we have for the referral. I assume ODA's kept you on, and you may want to use that as a guide and just see if that's acceptable or not, or if there's something below that. Because I think what we're really trying to get are, from the cases that have been given to us as examples, they aren't the lower end of the substantial quantity, but much greater than the 10 grams or whatever it may be. So if y'all could take that in consideration, then we'll have the bill teed up for Tuesday.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Mr.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Paul Snyder.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we have not taken a position in support or in opposition to Senate Bill 1095, but we do have concerns similar to those raised by Steve Dole, especially as it relates to the forest counties in the south coast and southern part of the state. We have counties that are likely to develop two budgets. One would be if the Congress passes legislation that reinstates to some degree the federal forest payments, and one that would happen if it didn't. And they would be markedly different, I suspect, depending on what the outcome of that would be. I've talked with a couple of sheriffs, both of whom support this legislation, neither of whom knew, however, what would be the case with some of the rural counties in the event that the forest payments were not forthcoming. And it sounds to me as though the discussion that's preceded my testimony might be promising in terms of how to address that issue as well. If there were some language that could authorize the court under circumstances that would be described generally, that would allow the court the discretion to do something other than what the bill requires, depending upon the urgency and the circumstances, whatever the capacity remains of the county jail in that situation, I think that would both send a clear message to the court as to how important this issue is with the legislature and still allow circumstances that would be urgently different to provide for a result somewhat different than the one the bill dictates.
Okay.
And we'd be pleased as well to work with the proponents of the legislation to do that.
And questions first. Mr. Snyder, I appreciate your willingness to assist, and I'm going to ask you to do that, again, working with Senator Wissett. The one thing, I guess, is that it doesn't sound like the association has actually reached out to the 36 different counties at this point. I don't know if you've got enough time, but it seems to me that it would be could be fruitful to kind of know where things would be. Of course, clearly, if the numbers changes to what how we would identify a substantial quantity or what language would be used as to maybe the amounts that would be there, I do want to make certain that whatever we put in there is pretty succinct in the terms that are used, and we're not having a lot of ambiguity, because I think that would open up the statute modifications that we're talking about making in a way that could be, say, have unintended consequences. So with that, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1095? If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1095, and the intent of the chair is to have this bill back up in a work session on Tuesday this next week. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill. I believe our next one's going to be 1094, and I'm going to allow counsel to get here so give us an overview of Senate Bill 1094. And this is another one that we, I guess we haven't actually had any testimony on this at this point.
That's so great, Mr. Chair. The only other bill we have up is 1072, and we had a hearing on that the other day. 1094 comes to you from Chief Sponsor Senator Winters. Requires a police officer to confiscate a registration card and mark the plate with a sticker of a vehicle if the driver of the vehicle is arrested for or issued a citation for driving a motor vehicle while the driver's license is suspended or revoked. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is similar to a bill that was passed in 1989 and sunsetted in 1994.
Okay, so 89 and 94 were the date? Yeah,
that's
on the back, background. Okay. Okay, yeah. You can do it from here.
Okay.
What we're going to do is start with an opening from Senator Wissett. This is a bill that a primary carrier or sponsor is Senator Winters. She, because of her travel plans, are not able to be with us today. She has asked, and Senator Wissett has been gracious enough to give an opening for her. And as I told her, we would go ahead and do the public hearing today, get the testimony in, with the understanding that we would put it on for work session next Tuesday based on some anticipated amendments that will be coming in if they're not already prepared. Senator?
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 1094 would reinstitute Oregon zebra sticker law to identify automobiles that have been driven by a person with a suspended or revoked driver's license. The presence of the zebra sticker on the license plate creates probable cause for a law enforcement officer to stop that vehicle for no other reason than the likelihood that the driver may be driving while the driver's license is suspended or revoked. The statute would require the police officer to confiscate the vehicle registration card if present, and place a zebra sticker over the license plate tag of any vehicle driven by a person who the officer is citing or arresting for driving with a suspended or revoked driver's license. The bill provides for certain exceptions depending on why the driver's license was suspended or revoked. A well-designed study has shown that when the zebra sticker law was previously in effect in Oregon, that highly statistically significant reductions in moving violation rates and crash rates resulted. These included nearly 13% reductions in rates of moving violations and about an 11% decrease in crash rates, suggesting that suspended offenders were either driving less or driving more safely. In order to minimize the fiscal impacts of the current bill before us, it is more narrowly focused upon drivers suspended for DUII, repeat traffic violations, repeated license suspensions, and license revocations. This is a good bill that will significantly help to remove the most dangerous drivers from our streets and highways. I believe it's well worth the cost, and I would urge the committee to pass this bill. The study that I cited also had some information in it from Washington that did not come to the same conclusions. But when you dig down into the report, the Washington conclusions were inconclusive, if you will, because there was no requirement during that time that the law was in effect in Washington for the licenses, the stickers that had been covered with the zebra stripe to be recorded anywhere. So in Washington, they had no raw material to draw conclusions from. Therefore, the conclusions were inconclusive. It's sort of a circular argument. I don't even know why it was in there. I mean, I can't imagine somebody paying somebody to do a study on something that doesn't have any raw information. But nonetheless, there may be some discussion on the Washington inconclusive report, and I would urge those who are contemplating that to actually read the report. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a couple people who signed up for this one. Tom McKellen and then Ann Christian. Why don't you both come up? And John Powell. So I've got two neutrals and one against. And so why don't we start with the against? So Ann, why don't you start and then we'll do the two neutrals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ann Christian. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And, Senator Whitsitt, I have read both reports, the Oregon report and the Washington State report, with regard to the previous pilot project with the zebra stickers. And we have concerns about this based upon a number of the issues that were raised in the Oregon report on the use of zebra stickers. And I have read through the bill, I have to admit, only two times, and I don't see anything in the bill as currently drafted that would address one of the big issues that I believe occurred with the pilot project back in the early 90s, and that was people removing the zebra stickers. I remember an Oregon State police representative at judiciary hearings mentioning that that was one of the biggest problems with the pilot program, that people got very good at taking razor blades and trying to get the stickers off. And the other concern we have is the base route problem of driving while suspended. I well remember when I was a public defender in the early 80s representing individuals who were charged with driving while suspended when it was more frequently a misdemeanor offense. And you basically have three categories of people. You have people who have failed to appear in court one time, a teenager, or who had failed to pay a fine and their license is suspended, and they're easy to deal with to get their license reinstated. And I didn't find when I was practicing that those individuals were the ones who were the greatest public safety risk as far as driving. The second of three tiers were the individuals who, primarily due to financial difficulties, found themselves in a situation where they had little hope of ever getting their license reinstated because of the accumulation of fines, etc. And the third group, it reminds me of the prior bill we were talking about. I had one client when I was practicing who at one time had 33 pending misdemeanor driving while suspended cases. And the bottom line with that individual was a severe drug problem, severe. And that is an individual who also wound up being charged with aggravated murder. When I heard the example from Senator Whitsitt on the other bill, it was like deja vu all over again. So I bring this up because we have concerns that there may be other approaches that would address the real problem of people driving while suspended that might be considered by the legislature. And I've heard there's a possibility, and I can't even remember who even told me this, there may be a possibility of another work group to look at the issue of driving while suspended. I was on a work group that Representative Linda Flores had on the topic, and we came up with some additional good ideas. And so I would just hope that there would be an opportunity in the interim to look at some of those other ideas, one of which is really simple, which is that when one sells one's car, you keep the plates. So I won't belabor the other alternatives. We have concerns that this is something that was tried before. The breadth of it, as far as the offenses that it applies to, misdemeanor and felony DWS, are of concern. And I don't believe Andrea Meyer was able to be here, and she asked me just to indicate that ACLU has some civil liberties concerns about the law, the bill as well. And if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Senator Orsett.
Thank you, Chair Prasansky. Ms. Christians, I'm more concerned about the outcomes of the previous Oregon law, where, as I pointed out, a significant reduction in moving violations and a significant reduction in crashes as a result of having those stickers. There's little question that the law as applied before was too broad, in that it took in people who had their license suspended for other reasons, such as lack of insurance or non-payment of child support. There's a whole laundry list. And it's unfortunate that we're such on a short schedule that the pending amendments to this bill are not ready yet. But we have made an effort to narrow this bill down to just address those areas, and I think that a work group would be appropriate here also, if that's amenable with the chair. But we're trying to narrow this down to those that have repeated DUIs and repeated suspensions and revocations, and those that are thumbing their nose at the law. And those are the things that we're after. It's much too broad a policy the way it's written. There are a couple of amendments that aren't even warm off the press yet that we hope will narrow that down. And so I would be happy to discuss those things with you also this afternoon as
Thank
well.
Thank you. That'd be great. Thank you very much.
You. Any other questions for Ms. Christian, Tom or John, whoever?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the acting administrator of the Driver Motor Vehicle Services Division, the Department of Transportation. I'd like to give you just a quick overview of the bill itself and how it will work if passed. And then I have a little bit of information from the two studies that were done on the pilot from the early 90s. So just kind of, for those who remember, refresh your memory. For those who have never heard it, it'll be new information. The quick introduction. The bill directs police officers to confiscate the vehicle registration card and to mark the registration plates with a clearly distinguishable sticker, sometimes called a zebra sticker, when the driver of the vehicle is arrested or issued a citation for driving while suspended or revoked. When a police officer observes a vehicle being driven with those marked registration stickers, the officer may stop the vehicle for the sole purpose of determining if the driver is operating the vehicle with a suspended or revoked driver's license. The bill authorizes the department to administer a new vehicle registration cancellation program and to cancel a vehicle's registration under certain conditions. The bill authorized payment of a $5 restoration fee after the registration card has been confiscated. So what the bill does, when a police officer arrests or issues a citation to a person for driving while suspended or revoked, the officer must confiscate the vehicle's registration card at the scene and mark the registration plates with a distinctive sticker. The officer will provide the driver with a notice of intent to cancel the vehicle's registration within 60 days from the date of that arrest or that citation. The notice will inform the driver of their right to request a hearing regarding the pending cancellation action and serve as a temporary registration card valid for 60 days from the time of that arrest or citation. The request for hearing must be received by the department within 15 days of the notice. The officer will provide a copy of the notice to our department, along with the confiscated registration card. When we receive a copy of the notice, we'll determine whether the driver was the registered owner of the vehicle at the time of the arrest or citation, and whether the driver was actually suspended or revoked at the time of the arrest or citation. Make sure there was no mistake made at the scene. If the department determines the driver was not driving while suspended or revoked at the time of the arrest or citation, we'll issue a replacement registration card and registration stickers at no fee to the registered owner of the vehicle, with no additional charge. If we determine that the driver was not the owner of the vehicle, the department will issue a replacement registration card and stickers to the registered owner upon payment of an $11 replacement registration fee and a $5 restoration fee. There's a number of conditions here. If the driver is the registered owner of the vehicle and was suspended and revoked at the time the notice was issued, we'll cancel the vehicle registration unless the driver provides some other proof of valid driving privileges to the department before that cancellation takes effect. If the driver provides valid proof of driving privileges, a pending cancellation will be stopped. Replacement registration may be issued to the registered owner upon payment of the replacement registration and those registration or restoration fees. If the registration is canceled, so if those 60 days have passed, the driver must provide proof of valid driving privileges and pay for a new plate, registration, and restoration fees before the registration may be reestablished for that vehicle. A police officer who sees a vehicle being operated with a marked registration, with those marked registration stickers, may stop the vehicle for no other reason than to determine if the driver of the vehicle is driving while suspended or revoked. It represents a probable cause for the stop of that vehicle. The previous pilot program was referenced by committee staff. It ran from 1990 through 1994. It was allowed to sunset. Very similar to what's proposed in Senate Bill 1094. There were two independent studies performed on that pilot. One was done by our department in 1993, just prior to the sunset. And some of the key findings from that study were that the driver was not the owner of the vehicle in approximately 44% of those cases. Almost half the time, it was somebody else. Yeah. It wasn't the owner. Most police officers thought it was actually useful and effective because it caused inconvenience for the driver, and it helped the police identify unlicensed and suspended drivers. However, they also felt, as was just pointed out, it was easy to circumvent because people were scraping those stickers and not particularly effective at keeping suspended drivers off the road. They continued to drive even though they had the stickers on the car. Stickered drivers were not more likely to become reinstated or licensed as well. That was one of the purposes of the pilot. Only stickered drivers who were suspended for financial responsibility violations, i.e. Insurance, had fewer subsequent traffic accidents convictions than a comparable group who were cited but not stickered prior to 1989. The 1997 study, done 3 years after the pilot ended, noted that there was an impact on those suspended for driving under the influence of intoxicants. The analysis showed fewer subsequent moving violations and accidents for that subset of the population, for those receiving a DUI. An analysis conducted over time revealed just that general reduction in moving violations and accident rates for that group. So it suggests a general deterrent effect for those with a DUI. There are amendments that are being worked, and we believe those will be ready by Monday for your hearing on Tuesday. What those proposed amendments include, we understand, would remove sections 12 through 15 of the bill relating to the increased penalties associated with driving suspended or revoked. The amendment will remove the references to ORS 811-175, which are the general driver license suspensions and the catch-all of suspensions, and will focus just on 811-182, plus anyone who is pulled over, cited, and arrested for driving without a license. We'll have to add a reference to that. But it will just remain with 811-182. So which is the criminal driving while suspended, those worst offenders, basically, that are still out there. And the habitual offenders are also part of that group. So, with these proposed amendments, the department will create a new vehicle cancellation specialty desk. It'll require additional positions to administer. Additional costs are anticipated for computer programming, forms, other implementation tasks. there is an effect on the number of hearings that are conducted, and that the Office of Administrative Hearings is actually the Employment Department. We pay for those hearings. The bill has an effective date of January 1, 2009. As we look at the resources that we have to devote to this, mostly IT resources, highly committed to other things, and some bills that are being considered this month as well, we would ask that there be an operative date pushed out to January 1 of 2011 to give us nearly 3 years, 2.5 years, to put this in place and do the planning that's necessary in communication, working with law enforcement as well, to make this work. So that's would also be included in the amendment on Tuesday when you hear that. So in summary, the bill creates a new vehicle registration cancellation program within the Department of Transportation. It requires police officers to confiscate the registration cards, mark the registration plates with a zebra sticker when the person is arrested or issued a citation. With the amendment, would be for criminal driving while suspended or revoked.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, Mr. McClellan, could you say again what that timeline was to implement and enforce?
We'd like to have an operative date. We can still have an emergency clause in it, but an operative date of January 1 of 2011.
That's something we probably should talk about more in the work session. That's mm-hmm. That's out there a long ways for something that seems to be pretty simple to implement. Thank you.
All right. Let's see. Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And also, Mr. Campbell's asked me to put the chiefs of police on record as well. Our concern is somewhat limited and somewhat helped by the definition of the amendments that was just given. But we would like some options for the police officer, depending on the circumstances that the officer finds him or herself in at the time of the stop. Some of these stops are take place. There are very dangerous circumstances surrounding, particularly in the rural areas where a limited number of deputies have limited backup. And if there is a situation, many times multiple people in an automobile, and perhaps needing to arrest them, and if they're driving while suspended, the normal procedure is to tow the car, have the car towed. Adding this procedure in the middle of that situation would then require, if it's a dangerous situation, the officer to then perhaps, if the tow is made promptly, to find that car and put the sticker on and get the card. Many of the people that are stopped in these situations are not cooperative. And as was just pointed out, many times it's not their car. In fact, in working on trying to get people to have insurance, I've been through I don't know how many task forces, and there's quite a bit of money being spent right now between the DMV and the insurance industry in sending vehicle identification numbers back and forth when policies are canceled, terminated, and written. Within 30 days, those have to be submitted to them. They have to keep records of these. They go into the system. The police can call in and see if there's a match. And even with that, obviously that database is always out of date. When people are changing, there's 30 days to get it in, and it's very confusing. And still, our uninsured driving rate is relatively high. Short of you know, putting some kind of constraints on their hands that they can't get to a steering wheel is about the only way with some of these folks that you can get them to stop driving. So our point is that we would like some discretion in here, depending on the circumstances that the officer would find themselves in, that this doesn't become a priority when their own safety or the community safety may be more important in that particular situation.
Okay, thank you. Questions? I do want to make a couple of comments. When I talked to Senator Winters, I told her that based on the original drafting of the bill, the chair wasn't comfortable moving forward with creating new crimes. And I do want to put on the record that there are already or I should say there is a statute already on the books, failure to carry and present driver's license, which is a crime. We can have individuals actually arrested on the scene if they fail to carry their driver's license and present it. And so if they're driving suspended, they're not going to have a license. And if necessary, the officers, I know in the jurisdictions I work for, use their discretion as to which ones are going to have, let's say, the that citation issued to them as a crime or actually taken into custody. So I think we have a mechanism now to deal with a lot of those individuals. The last is, while sitting up here, counsel leaned over to me and told me that he actually thought that he had some deja vu to show to us, and so we have our little exhibit of some of the old zebra stickers. And I said, well, see, that was black and yellow, but it's actually the black with the kind of the off-white shell color. So I'm assuming we can put these to good use if the bill goes forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with some Gorilla Glue, you wanted me to go around and selectively put these on people's cars this afternoon. Is that true?
Just a test.
Mr. Chair, would that substantially reduce the possible fiscal?
With the forecast today, I think we will be putting these to use. And it is all worth noting that the summary on this back in 89 was prepared by our own Bill Taylor, which probably had a little less gray hair at the time, maybe even had hair.
I didn't even worry about the color of it. I'm sure of that.
So thank you for memory lane. With that, thank you very much for your testimony. And was there anyone else who wanted to give us any testimony today on the bill that's before us, Senate Bill 1094? Oh, Brian, I'm sorry. You did mention you wanted to.
Very briefly, Brian DeLashman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Oregon State Police Officers Association. Both organizations have not taken a position on the bill yet, but we would like to be involved in any dialogue that occurs around any reconstruction or amendments. Let me just mention to one additional item, and I'll be off the stand. Don't get too hung up on the idea of these people getting very good at peeling off the zebra sticker. My understanding is, and a little patrol officer just whispered in my ear, that what the officers did to outsmart that was eventually when they figured out what was going on, they actually removed, before they put the zebra sticker on, they removed the expiration sticker so that if the zebra sticker was removed, there would be no sticker on there, and they would know that there's a problem, and they would stop those folks.
All right. So we need to issue the little razor, a window cleaner type things to take care of that.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 1094? If not, I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 1094. And work group-wise or discussions, Senator Winter, I believe, is scheduled to be back tomorrow from her travels. And I'm not sure if anyone's coordinating with her on that. So if they are, we might want to make sure everyone knows who's the point on that so we can make sure we can at least have the opportunity to consider those. And this one actually, if I'm not mistaken, has a referral to Ways and Means.
That's correct.
So that we do have another step here that we could have more dialogue. With that closed, then I think that's going to bring us to Senate Bill 1072, and I believe we need to open a public hearing since this is one of the bills that we had on Tuesday. And we need, I guess, to adopt the testimony from what we've had before. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the testimony heard February 5th, 2008, into the record, into today's record on this bill.
Senator Winsett moves that we adopt the testimony that was heard on February 5th when Senate Bill 1072 was before the committee into the record or in today's record. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And at this point, let's see who we've got for 1072.
Mr. Chair, if I could also tell the committee you have before you two sets of amendments, the Dash 2 amendments, which, as you may remember at a hearing the last time, unofficial hearing, kind of set forth in more detail what is a slat mill and how it's constructed. Also adds an emergency clause, and then you will see the Dash 3 star, which is an updated version of the Dash 3. And you have that before you. That goes to page 1. And what that does is on line 8. It would read, advertises or otherwise, when a person commits a crime of participation in dogfighting, if the person knowingly advertises or otherwise offers to sell equipment that the person knows or reasonably should have known will be used for the purposes of training and handling a fighting dog. In the dash 3 amendments we got, it didn't include fighting, and we've also elaborated knows or should reasonably have known.
Okay, so that's the dash 3s, and we also had one other amendment.
The dash 2, Mr. Chairman of the Committee. That defines out better what a slat mill is, and would read, a slat mill with running surface constructed of slats made of wood, fiberglass, plastic, or other similar materials. Those are the dash 2 amendments. Subsequent to this, if this committee adopts both amendments, pursuant to normal process and procedure, I'll send both of them down to the Legislative Council's office, and they'll be combined.
Okay. I had one person that had signed up on the witness registration as Ann. I don't know if she, you have here, if needed, regarding, I guess, the dash 3s?
Yes.
All right. And I know that there's been this discussion during this hearing. Is there a need for you to come forward at this point? That's up to you. Yep.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Christian, and I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. When Senate Bill 1072 was heard the other day, perhaps I made the mistake of reading existing law and found a concern with the manner in which the crime of participation in dogfighting occurred. Graciously, the proponents of the bill agreed to allow an amendment to be drafted. And in looking at that draft this afternoon, we had some concerns with the way it was drafted, not that it was badly drafted, but just perhaps another way to address it. And I believe counsel for the committee has typed up a suggested replacement for the dash 3 amendment.
Okay. So we're going to make sure we're doing this correct. Is there any questions for Ms. Christian? If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 1072. Now, what I want to do first is let's go ahead and do the dash 2s. That's going to be the cleanest, and it's just a straight motion to adopt.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 1072.
Senator Wessett moves the dash 2 amendments for Senate Bill 1072. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And at this point, what I want to make certain is, because we've got some stuff on the record based on the haste that we had to put together the three-star, what we will be giving to LC needs to be modified for those members. The star three or three-star, on the first line, it says on page 1 of the printed bill, line 8, after equipment, delete the rest of the line, and then it says and, it goes on down. But after the word and, we need to insert the line 9. And the reason for that is that if you look at the bill as it's written, there is the word dog that is on the original bill on line 9. That needs to also be deleted, and then we will be inserting, as counsel has said, the text that he's already put on the record. So I just want to make sure this is a part of the record so we don't get this hung up because we didn't delete the word dog where it needed to be before we inserted. All right. And that's the other part. I think we're talking conceptual amendment because we're going to really be replacing the dash 3 that LC did, and we probably need to go ahead and go through the formality of suspending the rules to allow us to adopt a conceptual amendment, which will be the 3-star. Senator, do you want to make that motion?
Senator Pretensky, I move that we suspend the rules to enable us to adopt an amendment that is not yet printed.
All right. Senator Wissett moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of having a conceptual amendment, which is the 3-star to Senate Bill 1072 to be considered. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And I think we can go ahead at this point and take a motion on the 3-star as we have not only have it in print, but also with the insertion of taking off that extra word dog on line 9. So I think it's just a motion to conceptually adopt the 3-star amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the Amendment-3, Star Conceptual Amendment, Senate Bill 1072.
Everyone heard what the motion is. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And now we will take a motion on moving the bill as amended to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1072 as amended by the -2 amendment and as by the -3 star conceptual amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wissett moves that we send to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation Senate Bill 1072 as amended by the -2 and the -3 star. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Counsel.
Mr. Chair, will the carrier be Senator Courtney by any chance?
I think it definitely should be Senator Courtney. I mean, we need someone with some, this was his bill, right?
That's correct.
So we will put Senator Courtney as the carrier of Senate Bill 1072 as amended by this committee. And I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1072. And, Council, I think that's all the work we have, but is there anything else?
That's all we have to do until Tuesday.
All right. And so at this point, the committee is not planning on meeting until Tuesday. If for some reason something occurs that forces us to try to do something within a 24-hour notice of posting, we'll let everyone know. But with that said, we'll plan on being here Tuesday at 1. Thank you for everyone, and have a great weekend. And the committee will adjourn.